in The Nature of Mind, The Nature of Mind is a striking panel. It's actually seven paintings, one major one in the center, and six smaller ancillary ones along the side. And The Nature of Mind itself is a phrase taken from Tibetan Buddhism, specifically taken from Dzogchen, which means the ultimate, radical, absolute nature of awareness. And the non-dual schools, like Dzogchen, maintain that the everyday mind, just as it is, uncontrived and without any elaboration or any work on it at all, is already enlightened, that we already have a fully self-liberated Buddha mind present. And yet, paradoxically, one has to search for it, even though it's never lost, even though you are 100% aware of it right now. In a certain sense, doesn't really become obvious until you set off in search of it and do certain practices. And it's sort of like if you think the earth is flat, we can't seem to talk you out of it, then okay, start sailing in this direction. And when you don't fall off the edge, then you'll finally go, okay, I get it. So The Nature of the Mind is essentially another term for the ultimate, but the ultimate that includes both formless and form. And so in this particular depiction, we have iconic depictions of the nature of mind and various symbols that particularly Tibetans use for the nature of the mind or aspects of the nature of mind, like the Vajra or Manjushri's sword, the circular mirror, the Tibetan syllable ah, which stands for nature of the mind, and so on. And it depicts, in a sense, the search for mind. Again, even though there's that paradoxical understanding that you really can't search for it, it's the searcher. And
I saw this whole thing as a they came about from visions, as most of my artwork does, and it came one morning, but it was after having read the Self-Liberation Through Seeing with Naked Awareness,
right?
And that Padmasambhava text somehow just really smacked me in a very profound way. And there was a sequence of visions and a poem that came along with it, and it was really quite a download.
Right.
And, you know, with plenty of stuff in between the panels that, you know, it'll have to await the animated version. But I'm sure that this was in some ways related to the ox herding pictures, you know.
Uh-huh.
Because it's very much of the person on the path, or they discover the path.
Right.
And they discover the teacher.
Right.
I thought of it as kind of like a medieval altarpiece meets Tonka painting, you know. So both these kind of, I guess, medieval pictorial or iconographic systems kind of fused in this Western interpretation of the nature of mind.
Right.
And so it has a heavy frame, unlike you'd see in many Tibetan paintings and things, but quite like you'd see in many medieval or kind of crucifixion or other kind of paintings. So the seven panels then go through the pilgrim finding their way out of their kind of tunnel of darkness, whatever that was. And there's a handful of masks and addictive types of things. There's money, all kinds of whatever the normal world distractions are that keep us from really contemplating the nature of mind. And so coming out of that reality tunnel, they find themselves they're headed toward the dawn. They're greeted by nature spirits, kind of hiding in the grass and things like that.
Right.
But there's this conjunction of solar and lunar energies on the horizon that head toward.
Right.
And as they go off, they meet a dead body there that is, we're presuming, is the body of the teacher, because they have a book in their hand, and I'm imagining this is some kind of dream code of the Tibetan Book of the Dead or any
right.
kind of the teachings. And then
and syllable ah on
yes.
on the book, which is traditional for the nature of mind.
Right. So there then in the third panel, it seems that he's read his book a little bit, maybe he's doing his Vajra yoga posture.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, Padmasambhava, the Guru Rinpoche, appears.
Right.
And
the book is still there. The book is just off to the left of him, again, presupposing that he has read it. And if I'm not mistaken, then the ah syllable is also written on his brain. So it's like he's really downloaded it.
Right. Yeah, he's doing the Om Ah Hung sort of Vajra breathing. And the seed syllables of all the Buddhas, I guess, is the Om Ah Hung,
right.
As is placed on all the Tonka paintings, on the back of the paintings and stuff.
Right.
And as a Vajrayana technique or Atta Yoga technique of affirming one's Buddha nature, I guess, the seeing those syllables in those spots
right.
make a difference.
Right.
And then in the central panel, we've got a kind of, the Padmasambhava is the source of light, the sun,
right.
Becomes the heart of the practitioner, and their ego, I guess, is more or less portrayed as a flayed skin pulled back by the different devas and dakinis. And,
right.
Spiritual forces that help the practitioner
right.
as they are reaching for the realization of,
right.
Of themselves. So in the center, then the sun becomes their own clear light and their own heart. And
right.
that's essentially my kind of psychedelic non-duality portrayal.
Right.
Although in this painting and the creation of the painting, the inspiration of the paintings, no drugs were involved, folks, just in case anyone. The only way that I do anything. That kind of translucent deity kind of thing, I think, is really normal for people who've done a lot of visualizations
right.
of that type, that they'll definitely see these kind of guardians, you know, in a variety of fashions. But sometimes when I've seen them, they appear kind of somewhat translucent, but they're, you know, energy.
Yeah.
And so from that kind of epiphany, I guess then it all snaps back into a Vajra,
right.
fractal Vajra sky with the yogi. Places one in their heart and comes back to the marketplace, I guess, in the sense of the ox herding pictures.
Right. Well, let me, if you don't mind, read the poetry that goes with each of these panels, because it sheds some light on it and it gives an overall sense of that the sort of path and what's involved and what's seen, and is very cool anyway. So it starts out, a wanderer from the west did go upon an unclear path. As bone and flesh alone they went through dark unholiness. A wonder can I find myself, brought clearing and a voice, nobly born, seek spiritual dawn. The path is open, it's your choice. And one of the paradoxical natures of enlightenment itself is that it really is a choice, as is the choice not to be enlightened. And all of that sort of becomes aware with the realization of enlightenment. It's at that point that you turn back and see that it really is the gateless gate, or that it's a path that has always been fulfilled and that there is no need to travel it, and so on. And it's paradoxical because the non-dual traditions all maintain that ultimately, radically, and absolutely, there is only spirit. There is only God. So even the self-contraction, even the ego, is spirit. It's just so radically the case that you're already enlightened that, well, as one of the Tibetan poems has it, it's just too simple to believe. And that's one of the things that makes the truly non-dual paths so paradoxically difficult, is they're so unbelievably simple. And that's because they're radically already accomplished. And they're already accomplished because there's only God. And so it is a choice, strangely. And so here we have our intrepid chooser off on his ultimately self-defeating search.
Yes, indeed. Exactly. And to add fuel then is the, I guess, the next panel.
Yeah, which is on panel two, and this is where he has discovered the skeleton that he presumes is a teacher. It has the book with the ah syllable written on it, and the poem says, "Along the path, death, mirror of future collapse. Animal powers surround and protect the teacher as a corpse. The teaching is taken. The sun emerges. Book of the dead, direct me, resurrect me." And that is one of the rather extraordinary things about the Tibetan Book of the Dead, is it really is a guide for living. Now, of course, it's also maintained that the stages that the Tibetan book describes, the three major bardos that a reincarnating individual goes through, that those really are there. That upon actual death, you're introduced directly into the Dharmakaya, or the causal, non-dual, pure, empty, clear light void. And if you recognize that, then you will attain enlightenment at that point. If you don't recognize it, you'll step down into the subtle realm. And there you'll be bombarded with hundreds of subtle, luminous deity forms, male and female, gods and goddesses, all sorts of elemental spirits and so on. And if you're attracted to some of those lights, you'll be reborn in the heaven that is represented by that deity. And if not, you'll move on down into the gross realm. And there you will see the people that are going to become your parents. And in very, very Freudian terms, the book says, if it's a boy who's going through this process, he will see the father, and they're making love, the couple is making love. He'll see the father and feel a great deal of jealousy and anger and envy, and will step in between them to try to separate them. And as soon as he steps in between them, he's immediately conceived in the womb of the woman. And the same thing happens with the girl. She has a great deal of envy and jealousy with the mother. She steps in to try to separate them and is immediately conceived. So according to the Tibetan Book of the Dead, we are all born in a Freudian mess.
A Freudian crucible there.
That's yeah. Right. But the secret is that the Tibetan Book of the Dead is also really a story about moment-to-moment existence, that moment-to-moment, we start out each moment one with spirit. spirit, one with Buddha mind, one with Godhead. And we just contract against it so that by the end of the moment, if we're not aware and awake, then we'll just be identified with this gross physical body and the little ego inside it, and we'll forget and not notice our supreme identity. And the next moment starts, and we're given a chance again to recognize our true self. And if we don't, we'll slide right down into identifying with a little bitty ego. And if we do recognize our true self, then we'll achieve awakening right there in the spot. So the Tibetan book is also really, you know, an exquisite map of moment-to-moment reality in this world. And, of course, the point is that if we practice those stages and practice recognizing gross, subtle, and causal states of consciousness and the ultimate dharmakaya, the ultimate nature or condition or ground of all being, then when we die, we will achieve pure awakening. We'll recognize that state and, in a sense, merge with it, move to become one with it. So this gentleman has discovered a book that is the secret to both life and death. And so he is on his way.
Absolutely. On top of that, there are evidently practices that have been given or some kind of instructions so that the guru can appear. And
yeah.
That's what happens in the next panel.
Yeah, and here, panel 3, climbing the mountain, slipping and falling, struggling to upper reaches, the path of practice can be long and arduous as it teaches. Holy book ignites a vision. Seeker becomes seer. Karmic preparation allows the face of the guru to appear. And this is beautifully drawn. And as you point out, the individual has the Om Ah Hung syllables at the appropriate upper three chakras. And there also seems to be a kind of subtilization of the energy body that you have him in. In the first panel, it's very, very clear that there's these three major energy bodies in panel one, for example, one that reaches about 3 or 4 inches outside of the body, and then beyond that, another one about a foot, and beyond that, another foot or so. So we have the gross, subtle, and causal, in a sense, represented. And then here in the third, I mean, same kind of thing in the second panel, with the chakras sort of starting to open up. And then here, there's kind of a subtilization, and you can still see the three, but the outer one is becoming much stronger, apparently correlated with his own increasing access to more enlightened and awakened awareness.
Oh, it's interesting because the whole guru yoga practice, I guess, depends on our accessing or projecting a higher, more evolved being that is a symbol of our own potential self-mastery, I guess.
Right.
It's like I think of Christ and Buddha as being these sort of representatives of the God self.
Right.
Certainly each had their particular story and of enlightenment and teachings and everything, but just overall and generally, the spiritual master is an archetype of one that is fused with the divinity.
Right.
And so any person who carries that archetype, in a way, becomes a model or a mentor or an attractor, somehow a magnetic evolutionary kind of transmitter,
right?
You know, that calls in the those that are ready to take the ride.
Yeah, exactly. And Guru Yoga is a very powerful yoga and can be practiced on really sort of all three major realms, gross, subtle, and causal. But the ultimate point exactly at the end of Guru Yoga is that your mind and the mind of the guru become one. And therefore, you also become one with everything that's arising moment to moment. And so one of the purest versions of the practice of Guru Yoga is after you've done some of the initial practices where you actually visualize your own real guru and visualize him like this in front of you or on top of your head or in your heart. You then move into the core of pure emptiness, which is the actual essence of the guru. And so one of the instructions, for example, is that when you wake up in the morning, just immediately look into the center of the mind. Immediately look for the source of thoughts. Immediately look into the source of I am-ness. And resting in that space, which is pure, vast, open, empty, translucent awareness, that is the ultimate guru. And so resting in that is to realize the guru's mind, which is your own true mind, which is Buddha mind, Christ consciousness, and so on. So that's where this individual at this point is starting to come into that direct awareness with his own true nature and his own true mind. And then at panel 4, which is sort of the central panel of the whole series, we have the three worlds are united from lesser to greater being. Vision spontaneously liberate as vastness nakedly seeing. Awareness supreme and central. Emptiness radiant and clear. Inner sun, outer sun, non-dual. In the heart, no desire or fear. Guardians cut loose my empty husk. A human skin pelt of turquoise sky. Reveal the mandala of great perfection. A resplendent Buddha, I. Which is well put, and particularly with the starkly white luminescent center of the mandala, I think it is a really good icon for the clear light void or pure, translucent, unqualifiable awareness. And then, as you point out, there are a lot of deities and deity forms as part of this process. At the top is presumably another version of Guru, and this time it has Samantabhadra and Samantabhadri, the ultimate primordial Buddha, which is the foundation of all Buddhas and the foundation of all reality, is present. So that's a profound part of the realization. And the gentleman is seated in lotus position, has all three of his gross, subtle, causal bodies, and they are all starting to become rainbow in terms of their own coloration. Traditionally indicates an awakening of the energies themselves, moving towards a rainbow body. And it's a very striking panel, all in all. I mean, it's really quite amazing. Was this when you say that you got up and you sort of had this downloaded vision after reading a Padmasambhava text? Did you see the central panel first and then the side panels? Or did it all just kind of come as one unified vision?
They did come sequentially.
Uh-huh.
But the first thing I saw was Samantabhadra.
After. Oh, wow.
The actual visions after reading the book or I started seeing, it was like one of the few hallucinations that I have that's, you know, like I'm seeing something that I didn't see it before, but now it's there. And it was a little kind of like crystalline, translucent, but alive, Samantabhadra.
Uh-huh.
And I was looking out at the, you know, I was outside and it was daytime and it was in a park-like environment where I just read the book, and there it was. It was like a bubble, like if somebody blows a bubble and it has that kind of shimmery iridescent about to pop, but there it is. It was like that. It was a little luminous. You could see kind of through it.
Right.
And it offered me a vajra. So I kind of closed my eyes, reached up and took the vajra. And it was sort of between two fingers. I was holding it like horizontal, just regular vajra.
Right.
And then it grew, you know, into one of those four-spoked vajras. And, and then started spinning. So it was spinning, and I felt, okay, well, this is like a diamond cutter or something, and I'll place it in my chest. And so that's what I did. Somehow, subtly, the spinning vajra that was sending out these kind of waves, just like in the next to the last panel, it was very much like that, and a lot of love webs spreading out. And so that's what it felt like. There was this gift of radiance that was being given.
Right.
And after that, it was following what seemed like infinite vajras on beads that were like beads, just going up and up into the heavens. And I followed these threads of infinite vajras up to realizing that it was Samantabhadri's hair.
Oh, wow.
And so I kind of got up into their faces, and then it was practically all over.
Oh, wow. So everything kind of hung off of that.
Yeah. It
was
that's weird.
Amazing.
Then these images, very, you know, much like a painting, kind of came out after that.
Yeah.
They were sequential. And it essentially summarized, I think, the visionary experience.
Right. There are six, it looks like, major Yab-Yum deity figures, a notable skull between the meditating person and the Adi Buddha, presumably the doorway of death through which one has to pass in order to find one's already awakened self, is the same themes going back to your very first memory, which is wild, so wild. But yeah, seeing that all coming off the hair of Samantabhadra's, that's really extraordinary. And is sort of where, of course, all the realization is coming from. So that's really wild. It's beautiful. Panel 5, the essential Vajra teaching condensed in a rainbow sun transmits a fractal message. Wake up, everyone. The inspired yogi reaches for universal truth's jewel encoded in a heart drop or a crystalline molecule. And fractal is just a pattern that repeats itself at different dimensions over and over and over and over and over. And so this one is wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up. So that's pretty good. That's a pretty good message.
All meaning collapses into these symbols. It's interesting that only in the context, like we were talking about in the former panel, the fourth panel, the central light, the sun basically is just white.
Right.
You know, you could have a big white canvas and say, oh, that's enlightenment.
Right.
There it is.
Yeah.
If you know, we know that it's only in relationship to other elements do we derive meaning out of anything.
Right.
And tell that it's not the bark of a tree we're talking about. We're talking about the bark of a dog.
Right.
So the central little white light there is only meaningful because of all the iconography that's already taken place around it.
Right.
That informs us that, oh, now that means
right.
the causal source of everything. Okay, now that nothingness is anticipatory of everythingness. Okay. so with that context, then the condensing of even all that into the sort of fractal Vajra sky
right.
Is a reduction. It is now it's taking away a number of other reference points. It's becoming more essentialized.
Right. Right. And the features are fractal because in terms of the number of figures, it's relatively modest, actually. It's really a double Vajra, and that is the item that is fractalized. It's just sort of more and more and more and more of those, getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and at the same time spreading out to cover everything. So you can, in a sense, you certainly start to get the impression that everything is a Vajra, an ornament of spirit. Everything is a manifestation of this enlightened mind. And there's not that much else. There's the meditator, and he's now got his hands over his head, traditionally in the trans seventh chakra position, and the subtle energies are now completely smoothed out into a sphere. And he's right in the middle of that sphere with one of these double Vajras right at the top of his head. And then that's essentially the figures. So what's great about this is enlightenment always carries, I mean, when you have these sort of Satori experiences, they're paradoxical, because on the one hand, things are very, very complex, because you're sort of seeing all of these enormous number of items all interwoven into Indra's net. So and that Indra's net is just, you know, unbelievably complex. And yet at the same time, they're all interwoven into one thing. It's just you're essentially experiencing something with one taste. It's one mind, one spirit, one self, one reality. And so there's also, in addition to a feeling of complexity, there can be feelings of just absolute enormous simplicity. And I think that panel 5 really conveys that double possibility really well, because in some ways it looks very complex, but if you actually look at it, it's really very simple in certain ways.
Yeah.
Panel 6, Diamond Scepter Vajra, pure of stain or ill, now has found its heart's home as the engine of creative will, empowered to penetrate others with primordial waves of bliss, shimmering, resonant love webs spread out to boundlessness. I love that. I love the love webs and spreading out to boundlessness. A love web is a great phrase, and it's just a perfect image for a sort of infinite, all-encompassing love. And this particular panel has sort of more a sense of a kind of returning to all of manifestation. So there's some more complexity, and there are more features, and we're seeing, you know, the brain and heart and these love webs, these crystalline love webs, also kind of fractalized throughout the entire painting. And the gentleman is just holding double vajra with that clear, brilliant white light center right over his heart. And it's really a stunning image. It's really quite beautiful.
It was, I guess, the closest kind of that you get to the figure as well. And this is the most, in a way, like the vision that I had. This was, you know, when I kind of closed my eyes and took the vajra. It felt very much like that, that if you could imagine two of those prongs kind of spinning around in a way, and like a rotary blade or something.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah.
I think that when someone sees that and they see that there's something that's been placed in the heart or that the heart is radiant, that there's an anticipated sense that one can empower oneself with whatever the teachings are, and here the Vajrayana or the Akti teachings.
Right.
It's an icon that points to that empowering possibility.
Right, right. It's one of those images we talked about that, you know, shows you what you can become. And that's where art has this transformative pull, because really superb artists, they are depicting some, you know, higher state or stage of being, and depicting in a way that when the typical viewer looks at it, then they get that resonance. They can start to feel that in themselves. And that's the power that art has to transform, the power that art has to, you know, show you these dimensions of your being that you didn't even suspect were there sometimes. And yet, you know, here they are. And you can actually start to get a resonant transmission from the artifact, from the artwork. And like I say, this is the closest figure. It's the closest depiction of the figure in any of the panels. And that it has, that's essentially a representation of the awakened heart is, you know, it's really beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then, like you say, a little bit being similar to the Zen Oxfording pictures and the last Zen Oxfording picture is, it just says that the individual now awakened enters the marketplace with open hands. What you have here, all beings and things included in the Bodhisattva's vow, therefore a return to the world, but in touch with the timeless now, an elixir of wisdom and compassion does Maitreya bring to all. Everyone is a future Buddha. Listen deep for the inner call. And Maitreya is the future Buddha. And that is, since all of us are always already Buddhas, then we are also slated to be the future Buddha. And what's interesting about this is the figure itself is then surrounded by seven figures, and they, in terms of the density of the energy of these figures, really sort of look like they're spanning the spectrum, really sort of from causal down to subtle down to clearly much more gross oriented individual on the right of the panel, which you could read in any number of ways. One being, here's our average person again, looking at his potential, at what he could become. And that is a seed that's starting him on his path that will take him through these panels and end up here, awakened.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Yeah, they're really contemplating it like,
Yeah.
That's funny. I hadn't thought of the number of people that are there. So actually, there's a baby in the
there
hands.
Is.
There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then the Maitreya figure would be number 8.
Yeah.
There's a lady that's kind of holding the baby, I think, at one point. Yeah, so that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, with the
And the person entering the marketplace, the person, the bodhisattva, is really strikingly drawn, and what you've chosen to represent there is really interesting, including the basic chakras awakened, and a vase, presumably containing some sort of amriti or elixir of eternal life or awakened awareness, and a hand mudra, and then these really rather absorbing figures, these seven figures on the side. It's really an absorbing panel, all in all. I mean, it's really carefully done and conveys a lot more than it might seem to it at first glance.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, there's at least one of the people in the assembly there that is completely ignoring the presence of the future Buddha walking among them and stuff. And there's everything from complete non-noticing to sort of mild interest,
right,
to you know, practically fear, but it's, you know, to kind of contemplation, but they're definitely not in the same state,
right?
And so it's kind of the observance of an enlightened being, if such could be seen, and it raises the question, or hopefully addresses that question, you know, are Buddhas possible?
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like you have to, you know, before you can think whether enlightenment exists or a spiritual world exists, you kind of have to have an experience, I suppose, that convinces you that these things are the truth, that they are real. So the onlookers are basically at that question.
Right. Know? Right. And they're not going to really know until they have performed a practice that the bodhisattva has, that this individual has. Because it really is something that you don't quite believe until you've really experienced it. And then it amounts to, of course, a proof for the existence of God. I mean, it's an absolutely dramatic, straightforward, undeniable experience, like looking at a tree or eating an apple or listening to Bach. It's just an undeniable experience. It's just not particularly physical. It's not particularly mental. It's spiritual. And then you experience that, and then it's undeniable. And there's a certainty that comes with it that is, you know, just can't be put down. And so the figures around this central figure are all in various degrees of, you know, sort of don't know, not sure, maybe, not paying attention, totally asleep, partially awake. And in other words, back in the real world.
Right.
Well, listen, my friend, I really want to thank you for taking as much time to do this. We're gonna have another chat and talk about four of some of your central paintings as well, so people will get a chance to hear all of this. And we're just, you know, delighted to have you join us in this way and to let us use this material. It's just so exquisite. And, of course, you have so many fans here, starting with me. And so this has been great, and I will be in touch, and we will set up our next talk.
Fabulous, Ken. Thank you for the extensive analysis and investigation into this work. That you have cared and paid attention to this work throughout our friendship together has been one of the greatest sources of joy for, for me in my life, and education as well. So much appreciated, and for all of the work that you're doing with Integral Life and all of the friends and devoted workers that have done so much to bring your organization up. We salute you, we honor you, we love you, and thank you.
All the love in the world to you, my friend, and talk to you soon, buddy.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.